Certain information set forth in the podcast may contain forward-looking statements under applicable security laws. These statements are not guarantees of future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. Although forward-looking statements contained in this presentation are based upon what management of the company believes to be reasonable assumptions, there can be no assurance that forward-looking statements will prove to be accurate. LifeSci Advisors and the company undertake no obligation to update forward-looking statements in the podcast should circumstances or management's estimates or opinions change. This podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not an offer or solicitation to buy securities and does not constitute investment advice.
FGF21 is unique because FGF21 clearly defats the liver very significantly. We've shown it in our studies in NASH. We kind of, in one study in 12 weeks, one study in 20 weeks, we reduced liver fat at the high doses by like 65%. It's a very significant impact.
Hello, my name is Neil Canavan, and this is Benchtop Bios, a podcast series by LifeSci Partners where we introduce healthcare investors to the people and the pipelines driving the biotech sector forward. My guest today is Rohan Palekar. He is the CEO of 89 Bio. Rohan, welcome to Benchtop Bio.
Thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure to be on your talk.
Well, yeah, thank you for joining me this morning. I realize you're out in San Francisco. It's a little bit early this morning. So let's orient our listeners with your company. So what's the elevator pitch here? Where are you headquartered? How long you've been headquartered? And give me an idea of what you're doing there.
Sure. So 89 Bio is a clinical stage company focused on liver and cardiometabolic disorders. And our lead program is a program called pegozafermin, which is a FGF21 analog, which we believe could be transformational for patient care in these two disease states. Mm-hmm. And we are in mid to late stage development. We are developing the molecule for two pretty significant indications. One is NASH, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Mm-hmm. And the second one is severe hypertriglyceridemia, which we call SHTG. And this is patients with elevated levels of triglyceride, specifically above 500 mg per deciliter. Okay. And in both these programs, we are in phase 2B or in SHTG, looking forward to moving into a phase 3 program in 2023, pending FDA regulatory approvals. The company, Neil, was founded only 4.5 years ago, in the middle of 2018. Originally, was founded with a very small group in Israel, where we acquired the product. I was the first employee here in San Francisco in the second quarter of 2018. And here we are headquartered in the Bay Area.
All right. We're going to get a lot more about your clinical programs in a few minutes. And I might even ask you about the name. But first, we're going to talk about you. You are the man in charge in Benchtop Bios. This is our mission here to get a little bit about the decision makers. So I'm going to just start just as basically as I can. When were you founded? When and where? Where are you from?
I was founded in Mumbai, India. That's where
Mumbai, India.
I'm not going to date myself by giving my age.
No, I don't do that. That's not fair. But I will ask you a little bit about that place since I'm not familiar with it. And just give me a bit of a little color on your earliest memory. Let's say it might be a really odd relative or a particular holiday celebration or, I don't know, your first pet. Give me an early memory.
You know, my fondest memories growing up in India is being with family, cousins, and celebrating a lot of the Indian festivals. So we just had the big Indian festival called Diwali, which actually was earlier this week. And it's kind of the equivalent of what Christmas here is. Everyone comes together. And I really have fond memories of those days, of the whole family coming together and celebrating as one big happy family.
It's definitely a thing here in New York. It's a large Indian community.
Yeah.
All right. So now give me a hero. What was that young man, someone you looked up to? I don't know, movie star, sports person, your grandfather?
I know it kind of might sound a little cliche-ish, but I think my hero was actually my dad and my mom. And the reason I say that is they installed some cultural values in me and a value system, which has been kind of the guiding light for me through most of my life. And they kind of really pushed and challenged me to be who I can be. So I always look to that. My dad, unfortunately, this year passed away, and I kind of remember those things.
I'm sorry to hear that. All right, well, let's move on to those values that instilled in you and where it led you to. At first, it led you to university. You went to the University of Mumbai.
you had a degree in law. You also had a degree in finance, so two undergraduate degrees. Did you then just go right to work from that, or was there more schooling?
No, so I started my career in India working in public accounting for those days, one of the companies now, which has become a big four. And at that same time, Neil, I was qualifying for becoming a chartered accountant, which is kind of the British system of the equivalent of a CPA. So I got my equivalent of the CPA, my chartered accountancy degree in India. And at that point, kind of then transitioned and came to the US for a business graduate degree.
So I see from LinkedIn that was at Dartmouth. How hard was this to tell your parents you were leaving?
It's tough, right? To leave kind of and come 10,000 miles away. But I just felt it was something which would broaden my vistas and give me some unique diversification and some unique experiences. Mm. It was a little bit of a transition coming from Mumbai, which is typically 80 degrees all year round, to New Hampshire, which can be somewhere between 0 degrees and 10 degrees on a nice day in winter.
Do you remember the first time you saw it snow?
It was beautiful watching the snow, and then the snow doesn't melt for 6 months there.
No, then it piles up and gets dirty like it does here in New York.
Okay. It was a great experience.
It must have been a very fruitful education because your first job after that was with a little startup called J&J, Johnson & Johnson. I'm just going to a bit of history here because I like history. This company was founded in 1886 by Robert Wood Johnson. He founded it with his brothers, James, and their first product was a line of ready-to-use sterile surgical dressings. They actually did pretty well. They continue to do well. In 2021, their sales topped $93 billion. And according to Wikipedia, it's one of the world's most valuable companies. So you landed well, sir. Now, you were there for quite a while. You did, 10 years there as a marketing director. You were then at Centicor, which became a subsidiary of J&J in 99, I believe. You were there for 7 years. So that's quite a long run for someone in biotech. So big successful company. You obviously were running a team of some sort. So I want you to give me an example now that has to do with leadership, something you learned there. Maybe not, you didn't learn in your MBA, but you learned it at J&J at your desk there. Something about how to allocate resources, how to spot talent, how to fail early. A lesson that you take into your leadership role today.
So J&J was a phenomenal employer, and I really enjoyed my 16 years there. I think one of the things is the importance of people and team. So J&J is very focused on how do you develop people? How do you give them different experiences, including myself? I did everything from consumer marketing to professional marketing to running R&D teams. Mm. And this is someone with a commercial background. But it was all about developing people, which I think was pretty phenomenal. And then the other one was it was a principles-based organization, meaning what's well known is about the J&J credo. And people have these things, but they really lived it. And it was always about putting customers, patients, they are the primary audience, mm-hmm. then it's employees, and then it's community. And so those were some of the kind of bigger leadership traits I took away from my 16 years there.
So obviously we're talking about healthcare, and anyone in the industry knows it's different from other industries. It really is. Why did you pick healthcare? How did this opportunity come to you?
So I think what appealed to me, and now I've spent 30 years in healthcare, is it's one of those industries where you can make an impact on others mm-hmm. while at the same time fulfilling your needs, right? And I take that pretty seriously, right? Because what we do is we develop drugs, and you can talk about it. In my earlier career, I was working on the Tylenol businesses, right? I worked then on Remicade, which is a pretty powerful drug. Now we're doing pegozafermin. But it can really change someone else's life. And that to me is incredibly appealing, right? There are a few industries you can do that where you can have that impact on individuals and society. Yeah. And in fairness, at the same time, find it fulfilling and rewarding, and you're compensated for doing it. Yeah. That's pretty neat.
Okay, I'll tell you now, you were there for quite a while. I'm going to assume that after some time, you start to get scouted from various other companies. And you got an email or a call or something around 2008, and you went to Medivation halfway across the country, well, all the way across the country. Was it just a really good offer, or what was the opportunity?
So it was a unique opportunity at that time. I think it was maybe the 20th employee, and Medivation at that time had a drug which they were developing for Alzheimer's disease, and they had seen some really positive phase 2 data. And they were looking for someone with more of a business commercial background, and I came in as the chief commercial officer. It was a kind of a broad role. It was commercial, medical affairs, and manufacturing. So it was kind of broad. But what was appealing to me, Neil, was I'd spent a long career with a big company, but the opportunity to be at a startup and in a space where there was a very significant unmet need and you could have a transformational impact. And so that's kind of what got me to pick up my bags and move from New Jersey to San Francisco.
All right. So you're Medivation for a nice little run. And then you joined another California-based firm called Avenir. This is also a company that also had CNS assets, by the way. So you were there for 5 years. You rose from chief commercial officer to become the CEO. Now, in our conversations so far, you don't strike me as really type A. So was this transition just naturally came into you, or was this something you really pursued?
So it was a good opportunity which came back. Again, that company, Avenir, had a wonderful drug for an indication called pseudobulbar affect, a very underappreciated, undertreatment disease state. And this is people with neurological disorders who have emotional outbursts. And I thought it was a pretty interesting. Again, they just kind of commercialized the drug. I joined in initially as the chief commercial officer. And then over time, the company got acquired by Otsuka, which is another wonderful, large Japanese drug company. And then kind of transitioned to become chief operating officer and then the CEO of that company.
Okay. And then we moved on to the subject at hand is 89 Bio. So again, same question. You seem to be doing it well in your other position. Why move on?
I think there were a couple of things which appealed to me about 89 Bio. One is it goes back to a theme which I've talked about. For me, the passion is at this point in my career, working in drugs where you can actually transform patients' lives and there is no really good alternatives. So the idea when 89 Bio was founded was to really focus on NASH. There is no approved drugs for NASH. And we can talk a lot more about NASH, but this is in some ways, you know, people talk about it being the next pandemic, right? Because today there's roughly just in the US, there's about 20 million people with NASH. With diabetes and obesity going up, they think by the end of this decade, it could be 30 million people and no drugs approved, right? So there was clearly a opportunity here to make an impact for patients. The second was the science with the target, which we are pursuing. I'm sure we'll talk more about FGF21, was really compelling. So when the venture capitalists reached out to me, I had a chance to talk to some of the experts in the field who they put me in touch with. I had not worked previously in metabolic and liver diseases. I've worked in multiple therapeutic areas, but this was new. And I heard a lot of excitement about the potential for this target to make a difference for patients. So that was number two. Number three, so I'd been at small companies. I'd got the passion of doing something small. This was going to be a company. I was going to be the first employee in the US. There was a small team in Israel, and we can talk a lot about it, but it's been such a phenomenal experience, right? You get a chance to come in and really define what the vision, the strategy for the company is. And then needless to say, it was backed by some really strong names in the venture capital community. And so you put all this together, you get opportunities to do this occasionally to kind of come in and build something from the scratch and with good science.
All right. Very attractive opportunity. I would have taken it too. So let's talk about that good science. You mentioned FGF21. This is fibroblast growth factor 21. This is a liver secreted peptide hormone, and it is involved in the regulation of lipid metabolism and glucose metabolism. As you mentioned, it is endogenous. So why do you want to make more of it?
So FGF21, it is an endogenous metabolic hormone. And what this hormone really does is it controls lipid, carbohydrate, energy metabolism in the body. It's associated with insulin sensitivity. And the way mechanistically it works, so in the liver, it results in fatty acid oxidation. It prevents the formation of new fat or de novo lipogenesis. But then it also acts on the white adipose tissue, the fatty tissue, where it controls a lot of the lipid carbohydrate metabolism and some of the insulin sensitivity. So it releases another hormone called adiponectin, which is an insulin sensitizing hormone. There's a couple of things which are interesting. So one is in the body, in the native state, it's at very low levels. It's at picomolar levels. So we give a lot more to activate it and really get some of the benefits, the metabolic benefits we talked about. One of the tricky parts with this hormone is it's got an incredibly short half-life in its native state.
Oh, okay.
In fact, it's less than 2 hours. And so what we've done, and to really make it a druggable hormone, we've kind of modified it with a unique proprietary technology called glycopegylation, which we use, which allows it to stay in the body for between 55 to 100 hours. And then you can dose it at these higher levels, given once a week or once every 2 weeks.
All right, good. So let's talk about the clinical program now that I understand a bit of the science. We're going to talk about the SHTG indication, the triglyceride indication. Obviously, you pointed out, look, obesity is basically skyrocketing here in the United States. Does that describe the unmet need right there? I mean, do we need numbers here?
Yeah. So everyone who's obese has incredibly high levels of triglyceridemia, right? So normal triglycerides, what's considered is 150 mg per deciliter or below. Anything above 200 is considered elevated, but anything above 500 is considered severe hypertriglyceridemia. And these patients are at a greater risk and a very significant risk of acute pancreatitis, which is not a good thing to have. But these patients also have much higher risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which kind of results in bad cardiovascular outcomes. And that we believe there's roughly somewhere between 3.5 to 4 million patients in the US with severe hypertriglyceridemia. If I look at hypertriglyceridemia, you're right, it's in the tens of millions of patients. But the other thing which is important, as you talked about obesity, is these patients tend to have a lot of other metabolic dysregulation. So most of them have a fatty liver. Most of them are obese. And we saw that in our clinical studies. Nearly 70% of them are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. So they have this constellation of multiple metabolic dysregulations. And unfortunately, they compound one another.
I'm going to touch on the difficulties of treating such patients or running a trial with such patients in just a minute. But first, I want to talk about the trial. Your latest trial is called INTRIGUE. Could you just describe the protocol for me and the endpoints?
Sure. So INTRIGUE was a double-blind placebo-controlled study where we enrolled patients with severe hypertriglyceridemia, and we treated them with different doses of pegozafermin. So all the patients go through a screening period to make sure their triglycerides are about that level. They were treated with a weekly dose of pegozafermin, three different weekly doses, starting at 9 milligrams given once a week, going up to 27 milligrams. And then we also treated one cohort of patients who were given the drug once every 2 weeks. The entry criteria was you had to have triglycerides above 500. And then importantly, because there are existing drugs approved in the market for the treatment of triglyceridemia, we allowed patients to be on background therapy of their existing drugs. It was not required, but we allowed it if they
were. Yeah, I was going to ask about that. It seems to be it confounds analysis just a bit with a polypharmacy.
Yeah. And that's important to note because what we wanted to make sure is we wanted a real world setting, right? Because if we're fortunate enough to bring our product to market, there's a very good chance it's going to be used on top of existing drugs. And so we wanted to prove that, in fact, on top of existing drugs, we bring value. And really, the experts wanted to see that too, right? And now we treated, I should have mentioned this to close out the protocol, we treated these patients for 8 weeks. And the primary analysis or the primary endpoint was reduction in triglycerides from baseline. So you take triglycerides measurement at baseline. At the end of week 8, you do the average week 7, week 8, and compare it with baseline. And that endpoint is important because that's the approvable endpoint to get a drug approved in the United States.
Well, let's go straight to the results. I mean, you had positive results. Just bottom line that for me.
Sure. We were very pleased with the results we saw. So on the primary endpoint, we saw a reduction in triglycerides from baseline between 55 and 63% in the once every week dosing arms. The bar I think everyone was expecting is anything about 30% would be pretty good. So to see 55 to 63% was great. What was also incredibly encouraging was we saw similar results whether those patients were on background therapy or they were not on background therapy. Okay. So a lot of these patients were on statins, some of them were on fish oil, some of them were on fibrates. And even though they were on this background therapy when they were given pegozafermin, we saw very similar reductions. Excellent. So that's on the primary analysis. The second thing which is really encouraging with the data set, why we're moving the program forward, is we saw very nice reductions on a lot of these other metabolic issues these patients have. So you recollect, I said a lot of these patients have multiple comorbidities.
Sure.
So we saw very nice reduction in non-HDL cholesterol. We saw very nice reductions in ApoB, which is an atherosclerotic marker. We saw some level of weight change. And then we saw nice changes on glycemic control. And finally, the one which has the expert community, the KOL community has really got jazzed about is we saw very nice changes in liver fat. So people have believed that these patients with severe hypertriglyceridemia have liver fat. But no one in a clinical study had actually documented that these patients have liver fat and then shown that with an intervention, you can reduce the liver fat. So out of the 85 patients, we did a sub-study in 24 patients where we measured their liver fat at the start, and it was pretty elevated. These patients had up to 20% liver fat, which is a very high number. And after just 8 weeks of treatment, so not that long a treatment period, we dramatically dropped their liver fat. So overall, we feel very pleased. And obviously, it's important when you look at efficacy, you also want to look at what the tolerability and safety profile was.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So what did you see? Any signals, discontinuations, anything?
So in totality, we had a very favorable safety and tolerability profile. We did not see anything of significant concern. We did see some AEs which have been observed with other FGF21s, and they typically tend to be GI adverse events. But most of them, all our AEs were mild to moderate. So they were all grade one, grade two, no severe AEs. And then you see it's an injectable product. I should have mentioned that. You saw some injection site reactions, but again, very well tolerated and very manageable.
You don't need to go to the doctor for this injection, right? Once we get approved?
So the plan is it would be a self-administered injection in a commercial setting. In a clinical trial setting, in some trials, we have had people come to the clinic, and in some trials, we are having patients inject themselves at home. But in a commercial setting, it would be a self-injectable.
All right. Obviously, you said you're moving forward. Briefly describe for me the next step.
So the next step is we are looking forward to engaging with the FDA, sharing this data, and talking to them about potentially moving into phase three registrational trials. And pending a successful interaction with the regulatory bodies, the plan would be in the first half of 2023 to move into a phase three trial, which would potentially allow us to file a BLA for approval. And we've got a comprehensive phase three program we've proposed to the FDA, which includes a trial in severe hypertriglyceridemia, which would be a single pivotal trial, classic double-blind placebo-controlled study. And we're using a lot of the regulatory precedents from other drugs who've been approved. And then we are also proposing doing a companion study. And the companion study is more so to generate additional data in triglyceridemia. So this might be in patients, might not be above 500, could be lower, but also to develop a safety database. So as you know, when you get a first drug approved, you have to generate a lot of safety data,
rightly so.
And so that's the plan. And let's see where the discussions and interactions with the agency go. But we are marching forward to getting everything ready to execute on a phase three program in the first half of next year.
Excellent. All right, now let's move on to NASH. As you pointed out, this is a huge problem. And I think most investors understand that this is also a very difficult to drug problem. You think you can. Why? Was this based on the observation of reduced liver fat? Why do you think you can tame this beast?
So NASH, as we know, it starts with fatty liver. Mm-hmm. Then the liver gets inflamed, and over time, it gets fibrotic. And in the severe stages, it's a pretty serious condition. And sometimes it's underappreciated how serious this condition can be. But at its core, it is a metabolic dysregulation. There's a reason these patients end up with all this fat and they cannot clear the fat, right? And so all these patients have very significant metabolic dysregulations. So just like in SHTG, obesity, diabetes, dyslipidemias, etc. Our perspective is to really have a very strong, effective therapy for NASH, you've got to address what's happening in the liver, i.e. reduce the fat in the liver,
yep.
Reduce the inflammation in the liver and impact the fibrosis. But then I think it's equally important to address the underlying metabolic dysregulations. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, otherwise, in some ways, it can become a leaky bucket, right? I can address what's happening in the liver, but I keep adding more fat into the liver,
less than
ideal. FGF21 is unique because FGF21 clearly defats the liver very significantly. We've shown it in our studies in NASH. We kind of, in one study in 12 weeks, one study in 20 weeks, we reduced liver fat at the high doses by like 65%. It's a very significant impact. We impact the inflammatory process in the liver and the fibrotic process. And there's an independent pathway in which we achieve and hit the fibrotic pathway. But then as we talked about, we improve the cholesterol. We impact glycemic control. We've shown nice changes in things like hemoglobin A1C and weight. And so we think the totality of the package and the broad metabolic effects that FGF21 has can really impact this disease state.
All right. So we do have data here, as you mentioned before. You reported a trial in January of this year. You did manage to hit your primary endpoint. However, in a call prior to this, we did discuss these results and you said, well, the histology results, there weren't a wow. And we had to figure out why not wow. Could you tell me that story?
So this study was a phase 1b/2a study, okay? Mm-hmm. And just to set the stage, so we had done 6 cohorts where we had tested multiple different doses of pegozafermin, both given once a week and once every 2 weeks. And then we picked the best dose from that, and we did a study with only 20 patients, so a very small cohort. So the first part was like 80 patients. The second part was 20 patients where we treated patients for 20 weeks, and we looked at histology markers. Before I talk about histology, it's important to note. So in that study, we saw very nice changes in liver fat, up to 60-65%. Very nice changes in ALT, which is a liver transaminase suggesting liver injury, 45% reduction. We saw wonderful changes on imaging. So mm-hmm. We looked at liver stiffness, incredible changes on liver stiffness. We saw benefits on glycemic control. We dropped hemoglobin A1C by 0.9. Which is some diabetes drugs do that, right?
Sure.
So we have this constellation across all the measures. We saw very, very nice changes. Now, in the small patient group of 20 patients, we looked at biopsies and we had a single reader read the biopsies. So they do a pre-biopsy, post-biopsy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And our primary endpoint was a scale called the NAS scale, which is the NAFLD activity scale. And a 2-point change. And we had 74% of patients saw a 2-point change, which is again amongst the best NASH drugs have shown. We also looked at two of the endpoints which the FDA looks at for approval of drugs. Mm-hmm. And one is called a 1-point change in fibrosis scale without worsening of NASH. And the other is NASH resolution without worsening of fibrosis. And in the first one, we saw 26%. And then the second, we had 32%. Now, both those numbers are respectable numbers.
But not wow.
Yeah, the drug is having activity. And many other NASH drugs are in that same ballpark. Okay. The wow, I think, is a very fair question is, when we saw all these other markers, we would have expected a higher number.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what we did is, in talking with the experts, because the experts were a little scratching their head, this mm-hmm. does not translate. All your other non-invasive markers, you're hitting it out of the ballpark. And so they suggested to us, let's have 3 independent new pathologists. Again, okay. All experts in the field read the data. Not surprisingly, the numbers were very different. Okay. And it was very similar to the confidence interval. So you saw fibrosis improvements up to 42% in one of the readers. You saw NASH resolution in the high 40s. And it's kind of interesting. And this goes back to the variability associated with reading biopsies.
Yeah.
And we've taken the lessons learned from this and in our ongoing phase 2B study. So after we got these results in January, we actually modified the protocol for our large phase 2B study to change the reading methodology to actually now have a 3-panel read. And so this is why you do studies, right? You learn from them and you make modifications. Because what this told us is you want more than just a single reader to minimize variability.
Is this the Enliven study?
That's the Enliven study. Yeah.
And when do you expect a readout from this study?
So we expect to have results from the Enliven study in the first quarter of next year. So we announced we completed enrollment in August of this year. Mm-hmm. It's a 6-month study to the primary endpoint. It's actually a 48-week study, a blinded 48-week study, but the primary analysis will be done at 24 weeks. And we look forward to presenting top-line data in the first quarter of 2023.
Splendid. I will mention that there is going to be a poster presented actually before this podcast is posted at AASLD, which is very, very near. So as you're listening to this post-AASLD, if you missed the poster, it is on the website and you can go ahead and dial that up. So finally, I just have two questions left, one for the lawyer and one for the banker. The lawyer question is pretty simple. Was this molecule in-house? If not, where's the IP? Is it from the Weissman? Where did it come from?
So the molecule was acquired from Teva Pharmaceuticals.
Teva, okay.
Yeah, so we acquired the molecule and we have on some of the glycopegylation technology a license. I'm glad you mentioned this. So we have a composition of matter patent on the molecule through 2038, mm-hmm. and that is without any patent term extension. So we've got a long runway. And this is based on actually IP which 89 Bio filed. So after we acquired the asset, we continued to develop new data. And based on some unusual findings, we got new IP. So we've got a long runway on the IP all the way. I'm sure we're going to get a few more years to the 2038 based on patent term extensions.
All right. And now for the banker question, this always comes last. Describe to me your current runway. And what sort of conversations would you like to have in the near future at JP Morgan and right there in your backyard?
So we ended this second quarter, which is the last financial statements as we speak, with $200 million. And that gives us a runway into 2024. And what we've talked about is we'll have the Enliven study results in the first quarter of next year. And we have capital for more than 1 year beyond that. So you can go into the mid-2024 as our cash runway. So we are well capitalized to initiate our phase 3 study in SHTG pending favorable feedback from the agency. And I think at this point, we continue to look at what is financing strategies which might play into if we have positive data from NASH. So our current financing supports the SHTG program. We do have some warrants outstanding, which are all in the money today. And if those warrants are exercised, we have the cash runway to get us through SHTG. But I think the conversations in the coming months, as we look at the pending NASH data, mm-hmm. how should we be thinking about capitalizing the company for that, for that data to be positive? And we look at both non-dilutive sources of capital, as well as potential equities. And the non-dilutive can span the entire spectrum from whether it's debt, whether it's strategic partnerships. There's multiple ways we can skin that cat.
All right, then. We have a wrap today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, sir. Today, my guest has been Rohan Palekar. He is the CEO of 89 Bio. Rohan, thank you so much for joining me today. With any luck, I'll get to see you in San Francisco in just a couple of months. Thank you, sir.
Wonderful. Appreciate the time, Neil. Thank you for having us, Natasha.
Thank you for listening to this week's Benchtop Bios. I hope that this episode will serve as yet another data point to guide you in your investment strategies. If you wish to hear more of Life Size Benchtop Bios, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Google. Also, if there's a company or a particular executive you'd like to get to know, I do take requests. Please send those to ncanada@lifesciadvisors.com. Until next week, then, goodbye, or for that matter, good sell.
whatever boosts your portfolio.